Hello, everyone, and happy Tuesday. Welcome to the Gentle Healing Group. It is good to see you all here. I'm happy to hear that some of you just enjoyed NTI John chapters 1 and 2, because next week your homework assignment is going to be reading NTI John chapters 1 through 7. So you'll be perfectly aligned with the teaching that Jacqueline just did. So what I'm going to do is get us started with a song. And the song that jumped out at me tonight is one by Michael Singer. He's not the singer of the song. Michael Singer is not the singer. He's the songwriter. So this is his song, There's a Place in My Heart. And, of course, for those of you who aren't real familiar with the name, Michael Singer is the author of The Untethered Soul, which, of course, is the book I'm sharing from during Gentle Healing. So here we go. There's a Place in My Heart.
Yeah.
Right. That song left me feeling so quiet I didn't even want to speak right away. So welcome to week 28, our 28th meeting of the Gentle Healing Group. And of course, as you know, we begin with your sharing. You can share anything that you want from your experience of healing or your experience of realization, as well as sharing on workbook lessons 174 to 180, which of course are review lessons, or sharing on letting go of the I am bad belief, sharing from the audio or sharing from your own experience with the I am bad belief. So the floor is open. Who would like to get us started with the sharing? All right, Sherry is going to get us started with the sharing. So, Sherry, the mic is yours.
Thanks, Regina. Regina, just a quick mic check. Just checking. Okay, great. Thank you. So, I'll share a little bit about my experience with the audio. So basically, it looks like we've been practicing root cause inquiry for the whole past 2 weeks, and I had listened to the audio that was our assignment a couple of times before, but for whatever reason, this time when I listened to it, I took a lot of notes, first of all. But there was, I was highly motivated to actually do the practice recommended in the audio. So the first thing I noticed about myself was how incredibly frequent the opportunity for practice actually is for me. I learned that I think I kind of falsely go through life feeling that I think I'm pretty content, I'm pretty happy, I don't carry a lot of grievances, etc. And boy, did I have a lot to see about myself when I actually took the time to look. I saw how often my sort of calm exterior is actually disturbed. So the first time that something, that it came up, the opportunity came up for practice was when I fell asleep listening to the audio. When I went to, and then I heard something in the middle of the night that startled me. And I live alone, so I got up to just check out the noise. And what arose in me was fear, because I had heard this noise in the night. But instead of giving in to the fear or sort of powering through the thought of fear and just going outside to check out things in spite of the fear, I stopped and I asked, yes, but why do I feel fearful? So, of course, the story that came initially was, well, because I'm alone at night and I'm vulnerable. Something might, whatever, might be out there that could hurt me. That whole attack and defend kind of thing. And then I dug deeper under that, and there was this sort of comparison of I feel weak and subject to being hurt. There's a sort of powerful thing out there in the world and a weak me. And the drill down was, yeah, but if my mind is totally healed, would feeling subject to weakness and getting hurt have my attention? I can remember Regina characterizing it before as, would Jesus feel fearful? Would Ramana Maharshi feel fearful in this situation? And of course the answer was no. The more I dug down, what I eventually found was that whole others being more powerful, me feeling less powerful, the us and the them, the better than me, that whole basic unworthiness. And it was just over and over and over again when I looked throughout the past 2 weeks, simple things would disturb me over and over again. And each time, the drill down resulted in that unworthiness feeling, that I was around the dinner table with my relatives, and their casual talk over the dinner table bored me. And I looked at that and saw that I felt like I was more spiritual than them, that I was better than them. So there's that unworthiness belief that I projected onto them. The dog was itchy. That disturbed me, and I felt like I wasn't a good enough dog parent, that the unworthiness belief there. I got a sunburn. That disturbed me. Like I didn't feel like I was caring for my body well enough. There's the unworthiness belief. It was exhausting how frequent the practice could get used for me. And I kind of felt overwhelmed with how much work that I had to do with myself. And oddly, there was this very, very small line that Regina used toward the end of her audio. It was kind of a sideline that really, you know, wasn't totally pertinent to what she was saying, but I wrote the line down. What she said was that I was letting go of defense everywhere. It was my job. And somehow I found that very, very helpful in shifting that feeling of overwhelm. I know that my kind of job out there in the world is lawyering, and my job here in my personal life is like attending to my home and my family and my relationships and my pets, my chickens. That what my real job is now, my purpose is simply to spend that time looking within, spend the time reflecting on that practice of letting go of those defense mechanisms. And so, for the moment, anyway, that is my job. And so I'll pass the mic.
Yay! Thank you, Sherry. You know, when I hear stuff like that, you know, it it's I spend a lot of time, you know, teaching and preparing for the Gentle Hearing Healing Group and also all of the MPP and all of that. But, you know, when people share in the way you just did, it's really worth it for me. So thank you very much, Sherry, for that sharing. And Stephen, you are up next.
Oh, thank you, Regina. And thank you, Sherry. I identified with a lot of what you said. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the audio, the I Am Bad one. On Sunday night, I just got back from Portland. Nancy and I were at a workshop for Myron, maybe somebody else here on the board, I don't know. But anyway, it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It was great. And so feeling kind of spiritual and all that stuff. And what hit me first, Regina, from, and I've heard that talk before, was very close to the beginning. You said, or what I heard were words to the effect that you weren't going to pay any more attention to your mind, or you were trying not to pay attention to your mind, or you saw that the mind wasn't even something you were interested in anymore. And I heard it in a way this time. It was like, first, the way you talked and separated out in your talk thoughts and beliefs, which is exactly the whole workshop we spent with Myron. So I heard it in a new way, were thoughts. I think I used to think that thoughts and beliefs were just sort of pretty much the same thing. And I don't think that way anymore. And the way you talked about them was very helpful too. But that mind thing kind of threw me, to just not pay attention to your mind. And it's not new information, because I'm thinking, hey, I've heard this a lot. And so as you were going through your teaching, I kept thinking about that mind thing, and do I need to pay attention to any of it, and how do you not pay attention to it? And of course, that's exactly what you were talking about. And let's see, which came first? Okay, I think the part came first where you were talking. I wish I would have written this down. The joke with Nancy, I forget some words in my head sometimes, and I blame it on this lyric, this drug that I take. I don't know if it's a joke or not. It's for nerve damage. But anyway, it seems like I forget some words sometimes. But the word had something to do with fraud, spiritual fraud, like people skip some steps and then they lie to themselves. And of course, eventually they pay the price or suffer the natural and expected consequences. And I thought, God, I wonder if that's me. How you described people, I wish I could remember the word. It wasn't spiritual fraud, but it wasn't far from it. Spiritual bypassing, that was it. That was it. And I thought that was kind of a gentle, kind way of putting it. Although, I'll say from the tone of your voice, the way I interpreted it was, this is a bad thing to do. And that, of course, that's just my interpretation. But I was, I identified with a tremendous amount of the signs of spiritual bypassing and had never thought of it before. And so it was really, really helpful to me to hear that tape again. And I kind of felt the same way with root cause inquiry. Like, hey, I've listened to it over the years. I've listened to a lot of them. And now I listen to them, and I just hear them differently. Of course, I don't know why that surprises me, but it's kind of cool to be able to do that. Then this is one of my favorites, because I don't know, other than this tape, if I ever heard you say, you know, like, hell no, hell yes, hell this. And I thought, go girl. But maybe you've changed the way you talk, apparently. But it was pretty funny to me. So thank you for that homework assignment, and I'll give it the mic. I really enjoyed it. I it was really helpful.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I'm really glad that you brought up that point.
This is Carla. Can you all hear me?
Oops. Yes. Go ahead, Carla.
Oh, okay, good. All right, so this is my first time to take the mic, and last week was my first time to actually be on Pal Talk, and so I'm pretty excited just to be on Pal Talk, and I really don't have anything to say. This is just part of my brave step today to be able to understand how to take the mic and to actually do it. And so that's all I have, and I just wanted you to let you know I was here. And next time, maybe I'll actually be brave enough to share something vulnerable. Thank y'all.
Thank you very much, Carla. It's really wonderful to hear your voice. And Stephen, I want to say to you, thank you very much for bringing up that point about the difference between thoughts and beliefs. As the point that I made in the audio is that the belief, the I am bad belief, is dead with me, but that doesn't mean I don't see the thought. It's just that now the thought can be easily let go, where when it was a belief, you couldn't easily let it go because you thought it was true, right? So that's really the difference. Once the belief dies, the thought may still appear, probably at a much lesser degree, but it may still appear. And when it does, you just go, oh, that, and you just let it go just like that because you know it isn't true. And it doesn't matter whether the thought has to do with you or whether the thought has to do with someone else. You just, as soon as you notice it, you can let it go. And that's sweet. So let's see. George, you're up. The mic is yours.
Thank you, Rajit, and hello, everyone. just wanted to make a comment about awareness, watching awareness. This morning, I woke up, I was having the most delicious dream. I was really enjoying it, and it seemed that I really didn't want to let it go. And as I was looking at it, you know, in awareness, I've been listening to the meditation where it says, you know, let your thoughts go by and just focus on awareness. And I, you know, this morning I really noticed I didn't want to do that. I wanted to enjoy that dream. I think that's one of my challenges is letting go of something that I'm telling myself that I really like and enjoy. So that's it. I am bad stuff to work on, but, it's a long-term project. Thanks.
Thank you very much, George. Speaking of dreams, I had another dream that I will share with you. It's kind of a funny dream. In this dream, I had a book publisher. I guess I wrote another book. And the book publisher wrote to me or voicemailed me. I don't really remember. But with all these things that he wanted me to do, all these questions he wanted me to answer, I'm sure it was probably related to, and travel, you know, travel to different places to promote the book. Just this long, long list. And I had to, like, say when I was available for travel. And there was just all this work that I had to do to respond to this publisher. But I had to go to the bathroom too. So in the dream, I had a recorder on my toilet. So I sat down on the toilet and I turned on the recorder and I started responding, you know, and I was looking at my calendar and answering when I could travel, when I couldn't travel, and all this other stuff. And it was really quite a bit. It was a pretty long recording. But of course, while I was on the toilet, I also peed. And right at the end, as soon as I finished the recording, I was about to hit send on the toilet so I could send the recording. And I realized, oh, he's going to be able to hear me pee in that. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to do all of that all over again. And as soon as I had that thought, I'm going to have to do all of that all over again, I woke up. But it was kind of funny because when I woke up, I didn't completely wake up yet. And so I woke up with the thought, oh, I'm going to have to do that all over again. And I kind of woke up with this heavy, oh, I've got to go do all that. And then I thought for a second, and I thought, wait a minute. I don't have a recorder on my toilet. That was a dream. I don't have to do any of that. And I was very, very happy. And then I realized, that's what waking up is like. Right? That's what waking up is like. And realizing that everything that we were believing is just not true. And I also realized that in order to have the experience of waking up from that dream, I had to use reason. Reason was looking and noticing, wait a minute, I don't have a recorder on my toilet. That couldn't have been true. And I think that that's what we're often asked to do when we're practicing self-inquiry. We are being asked to use reason to notice that the dreams that go on in our head, the stories in our head, the illusions in our head, aren't true, that they're just made up. And when we let them go, we can feel that same release that I felt when I realized, oh, that wasn't true. I don't have to do any of that work. So anyway, just a silly little dream that I had. Like I said, I've been having a lot more dreams since we went into the course again. So it's kind of fun for me. I think I went years with hardly any dreams at all, or at least hardly any that I remembered. And now there are a lot more dreams, and they seem to have a little message of some kind. So I'm enjoying it. Is there someone else who would like to share based on the experience of the last week with gentle healing? All right, Ken, the mic is yours.
Well, this has been a very unusual week, because last week I talked about the the young man, helping him with the tow truck and everything else. And this week I had a number of experiences with various people in stores that the situation would normally have caused great disturbance. Going to Home Depot, driving all the way up to Castle Rock, 90-minute drive, to get a specific riding lawnmower, only to find out that they didn't have all the parts and nobody knew where they were. And getting the manager to come out after they'd looked for an hour, and he just looked at me with this great apologetic look. And the thought of being angry with him over how incompetent can you be to not have all the stuff just went away. And there was great compassion for this poor man who was standing in front of what appeared to be an eye customer, ready for the tongue lashing he knew he deserved. And I just looked at him and said, "I'm not angry with you." And he kind of looked at me like, "Well, why not? I would be." And we ended up talking for about 15 minutes and shook hands and walked away with nobody raising their voice. And I ended up going back 2 days later to pick up the missing parts and asked for help, and nobody even knew how to work on this particular lawnmower. And that didn't, again, it's a little blip of get angry at their incompetence, and then it was, no, what is that going to accomplish except getting me upset? Mm-hmm. So it was, no thank you. We closed escrow on our house here today, and yesterday I had to get the balance and walked to the bank and said, "Oh, I need a cashier's check for $67,000 and the girl just looked at me with this blank look of I've never done a cashier's check for that amount. And it took about minutes. And they were looking for my signature and they couldn't find it because, well, Becky writes all the checks from her checking account, so they had to really look back to find my signature on it. And when it got done, it was, "Oh, thank you for your patience." And I'm going, again, what good would it have done to have gotten upset? It took the time it took. And I got out of the store happy, calm. When I left, they're kind of looking at me like, "Wow, never had an experience like that." And the guy was patient and he didn't get upset. And it's going great. So there's this whole thing, not believing that ego voice. And as with this work, the more I have daily practice not listening to it, the more it has gone to the background, and now it's just a little momentary blip that then goes away, and the heart kicks in and has compassion for all the people that are doing the best they can. So again, Regina, thank you for doing this. The impact it's having on me is fabulous. It's wonderful to live in this new state of mind. I very much appreciate it. Thank you. Releasing the mic.
Thank you, Ken. And yeah, as you were speaking, you reminded me of something that I read last week in the Untethered Soul. I think that was chapter 8 that I read last week. And it said something about the worst thing you can do is to act on the ego voice. So, for example, to see them as incompetent fools, believe that they're incompetent fools, then stand there and tell them that they're incompetent fools. And it said the reason for that is because then you pull them as well into that, so that the ego tirade gets bigger, you know, unless they happen to be enlightened enough to not get upset, which most people aren't. You know, basically you extend those ego thoughts by pulling other people into it as well. And so thank you very much for noticing the thought to get upset in those cases, but then just choosing not to. We are fully capable of doing that, and that's obviously the best choice. That's the one we all want to learn to make. So thank you. Is there someone else who would like to share? All right, Francine, the mic is yours. Hi, Francine. Just to let you know, you do not have the mic yet. Please try again.
Do I have the mic now? Okay, good, good. Just a couple of things on the I am that beliefs. I've watched it before, I've listened to it before, but there's a few things that jumped at me. And one of them this time was about the guilt, about the reinterpretation of guilt, to be more like our conscience telling us that we've made a mistake. So that's what I've been trying to do, is when I see guilt, I'm trying to look at it differently, that it's not I am bad. It's not because I am bad. It's just a guidance to let me know that I've made a mistake, and just be cautious in the future. And what would we be like if we have that? Regina mentioned that. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't know. So anyway, that was very helpful for me this time around. And the other thing is about fear, that we have to be, I have to be careful when I try to let go of fear, that I let go of the story also. So, you know, it's not just, fear is an energy that I can let go of it down. I can feel the energy and I can stay with it and let it go. But if I don't let go of the story, it's going to keep coming back. So those are the two things that right now I'm working on. So thank you. I'll see if I can release the mic.
Yeah, thank you very much, Francine. An important point that I think you pointed to when you're sharing is that concepts, or the example that I had in the audio about emptying the cup and then filling it up again, right? We need to both learn to empty the cup, to let go of the stored energies that we've previously repressed by practicing rest, accept, and trust. And that's also how we let go of the false beliefs, by practicing rest, accept, and trust. That's how things leave us. But then we also need to learn not to repeat the actions or the beliefs that filled up the cup in the first place, right? And, Sherry's sharing, I kind of felt for her because I mentioned in the audio that there was that summer before Laurent came when I began to notice that I judged myself with everything my eyes landed on, you know, and Sherry was giving perfect examples. You know, the one that I remember that she gave was that she's not a good, you know, she's not taking care of her pet well enough. She's not a good dog owner, or whatever she said. It just seemed like everything was a cause of guilt. And guilt in this case means the belief that I am bad. And this is something we really, really need to watch, because it is true. I mean, it's true that every now and then somebody else may tell you that you're bad. It happens, all right? So I'm not going to say that you're the only one that tells yourself that, because certainly other people project their I am bad belief onto you, and they'll tell you that you're bad. But if you were able to count, and I don't think any of us would have the ability to do this, but if you were able to count and compare the number of times you tell yourself that you are bad compared to the number of times that others tell you that you are bad, I feel certain you would find out at least 90% of the you are bad messages are coming from you, maybe even more than 90%. So although there may be others who tell you that, the worst offender is you. The worst offender is you. And as I mentioned in the audio, that is also true. Not only when you're telling yourself in some way that you are bad or ugly or stupid or whatever, but also when you have that thought about others. That actually fills up your cup. Because whenever you have that thought about others, what were the words that Ken used a while ago? Something about being incompetent. If I see others as incompetent, and I mean that in a very unflattering, judgmental way, what's really happening is that I am reinforcing the bad belief, right? The belief that there is good and that there is bad. The bad belief is reinforced, whether I am judging myself as bad or whether I am judging someone else as bad or something else as bad, a corporation. It doesn't matter. That belief is being reinforced. And if that belief is being reinforced, I am going to continue to suffer from it. It's that simple. So the only way that I'm going to be free of the belief is to let go of believing. And as I mentioned, that sounds hard, but it took time. I'm sure you heard. I had many, many stories about times, when it came up in a big way and I practiced rest, accept, and trust. And there were even more stories than the ones I told in that audio. But in a way, it's not that hard, even though it may seem to take time and there may seem to be several rounds of letting go. It's not that hard. You only have to do two things. When the I am belief comes up in the mind as a thought, typically as a judgment, all you have to do is decide, I don't want this. Like I think I said in the audio, I take it back. I change my mind. I don't want to believe that. I just don't want this. And when it comes up as an emotion, as a feeling, you practice rest, accept, and trust. It's only two things you have to do. So it's not hard. It's not like you have to get this textbook and study all of these complicated formulas about how to let go of the I am bad belief. There's only two things you have to do. It's just that you want to do them consistently. You see, that's the trick. The more consistent you are at those two things, the more effective it's going to be. So just like with everything else, it's the desire that comes first, right? The desire to let go of the I am bad belief or the belief in bad. You could just call it the belief in bad, right? And the more you have that desire, the more consistent you will be in choosing not to believe the mind's judgments. Again, they'll still show up. You just say, I'm not interested in that. I take that back. I don't want that. Right? You just keep countering it. And then when the emotion comes up, you practice rest, accept, and trust every time. What you really have to watch is you really have to watch the believing. Again, some people tend to believe more in an outward way, other people are bad, right? And some people tend to believe more in an inward way, I'm bad. But really, it's both the same thing. And so you really just have to watch the believing. If you keep believing, you will keep experiencing. But if you start deciding, I don't have to, if you could just trust Regina enough, when she tells you don't have to have that experience, it's not required. You can be free of it. And and then choose to take those steps consistently. And again, I don't know if it will be 6 months for you, a year for you, 5 years for you, 10 years for you. I don't know. But I do know that it's worth it. And again, in my case, it was about 5 years. But I'll tell you, when I look back on that 5 years, it seems like, you know, a moment. It took a moment to let that go, and it was so worth it. When I was in it, I'll be honest, it felt like it was taking forever. But when I look back on it, it feels like it took a moment. So I encourage you to stop believing the judgments of bad, less than, better than, because that's really the same thing. Who else would like to share? All right, then, if no one else wants to share, what I will do is I will start sharing from the Untethered Soul. To me, this is kind of a light chapter tonight, so unless Spirit gives me a lot to say as I'm reading, we may finish early tonight. We'll see what happens. There are a lot of chapters in this book that I adore. In fact, the next two chapters, next week and the week after, are extremely meaty chapters. But this chapter is a little bit light. So I'm looking at chapter 9 in The Untethered Soul. And I'll just start by reading, and then I'll stop and share when I feel prompted to. The name of this chapter is Removing Your Inner Thorn. The spiritual journey is one of constant transformation. In order to grow, you must give up the struggle to remain the same and learn to embrace change at all times. And I think this is going to be emphasized in this chapter. It's probably why it's like the second sentence. But I want to emphasize it too, that you have to give up the struggle to remain the same. Because what we don't realize is how much defense is built into our way of life. And in fact, I mentioned briefly on the audio, the I Am Bad audio, you know, that I worked at the, you know, I had a good job and a company, and I lived in the town that, you know, I wanted to live in, next to the people that I thought, you know, were really something, and maybe if I lived near them, that could rub off on me. My daughter went to the best school. But I don't think I hit very heavily that what I realized as I started really looking at that I am bad belief is that my entire life was a mask. My entire life, the decisions I made because I was trying not to look at that belief about how low I was, how bad I was, how unworthy I was. And I realized that I worked the job I worked because it had prestige. I lived in the town that I lived in because it was full of, you know, respected professionals. My daughter went to the school that she went to because it was the second best elementary school in the U.S. And not because, I mean, not because I wanted my daughter in the second best school. Because if my daughter was in the second best school, that improved my perception of myself and helped me to avoid looking at the I am bad belief. You see how this works? And that's why, you know, in the audio I talked about that first time that I practiced root cause inquiry. That's why when she wouldn't put on the coat, it was such a big deal. Because my whole life was a mask. And if my daughter showed up at school on that first cold day without a coat, the gig is up. Everybody'd know my life was a mask and that I was actually a loser, right? So what he's saying is you have to give up the struggle to remain the same. Yeah, and Jacqueline's saying that's why she went to Harvard. Because I think, Jacqueline, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I remember you telling me that you thought that you were, I don't know if you used the word stupid. Did you use that word stupid? Yeah, you did. She thought she was stupid. And so see how she overcompensated? Became a Harvard lawyer, right? Harvard Law School lawyer. So sometimes I think we don't realize how much of our life is driven by what we don't want to look at. And what I realized when I saw all of this was, oh my God, I don't even know what choices I would have made in life had I just been free. You know? I don't know what path I would have walked. In fact, I'll tell you why I'm not a judge. It's funny because, in a way, Jacqueline and I are opposites. Jacqueline became a judge, you know, in order not to appear stupid. I actually wanted to be a judge, and I didn't even try because I thought I was too stupid. So maybe Jacqueline and I should switch places. You know, if I had not had that belief in me, I probably would have followed that path, because I really wanted to be a judge. So we don't know how much our life is actually controlled by our false beliefs and our defenses trying to avoid these false beliefs. I mean, we marry the wrong people for the wrong reasons. We push our children to do things, not because it's what they want, but because it's going to help us avoid looking at our false beliefs. It's just ridiculous. And so, back to the second sentence. In order to grow, you must give up the struggle to remain the same. Because the life that you have built probably, to some degree, if not a great degree, is a life you built in order to avoid your false beliefs. And you have to give up that struggle of trying to look so good all the time, or trying to hide from whatever you hide from. In order to grow, you must give up the struggle to remain the same and learn to embrace change at all times. One of the most important areas requiring change is how we solve our personal problems. We normally attempt to solve our inner disturbances by protecting ourselves. Real transformation begins when you embrace your problems as agents for growth. In order to understand how this process works, let's examine the following situation. And I think that he had a lot of fun writing this chapter because he gets a little bit ridiculous in the example. But I think maybe we get a little bit ridiculous in the way we build our lives, too. So I may only read part of the example, but here we go. Imagine that you have a thorn in your arm that directly touches a nerve. When the thorn is touched, it's very painful. Because it hurts so much, the thorn is a serious problem. It's difficult to sleep because you roll over on it. It's hard to get close to people because they might touch it. It makes your daily life very difficult. You can't even go for a walk in the woods because you might brush the thorn against the branches. This thorn is a constant source of disturbance. And to solve the problem, you only have two choices. The first choice is to look at your situation and decide that since it's so disturbing when things touch the thorn, you need to make sure nothing touches it. The second choice is to decide that since it's so disturbing when things touch the thorn, you need to take it out. Believe it or not, the effects of the choice you make will determine the course of the rest of your life. This is one of the core level structural decisions that lay the foundation for your future. So like I said, I may not read all of this next thing because it gets a little silly, but maybe I will. We'll see what happens. We certainly have the time. He says, let's begin with the first choice and explore how it will affect your life. If you decide you have to keep things from touching the thorn, then that becomes the work of a lifetime. If you want to go for a walk in the woods, first you'll have to thin out the branches to make sure you don't brush against them. And actually, I'd say you have to hire someone to thin out the branches, because when you're thinning out the branches, it might touch the thorn, right? So you have to hire someone to thin out the branches to make a path for you so that you can walk safely through the woods. Since you often roll over and touch the thorn when you sleep, you have to find a solution for that as well. Perhaps you can design an apparatus that acts as a protective device. And then he gets a little bit silly from that point. But basically, as he goes on, what he's really saying is you have to design your whole life around this thorn. And again, that's what we do. We design our lives in a somewhat unconscious way so that we don't have to experience our triggers, so that we don't have to feel the I am bad belief, as well as the other false beliefs that we carry with us. And sometimes I watch some of my friends, how much they protect themselves, and I actually feel a little sorry for them, because I see the prison that they're in. I watch my own daughter, to some degree building that prison around herself. And of course I've, you know, told her what she's doing, and you know, she doesn't believe me. And then she goes on and does it, and I know I did it too, and you know, that's just the way it is. But it's sad. And so this first choice of building our lives so that, you know, nobody ever touches our inner thorn, or at least touches our inner thorn as little as possible, in whatever way we do it, is a really sad choice. And then we get so scared to step outside of our little safety zone. We get scared to release control in whatever way we've controlled things. And yeah, Joanne is saying we protect ourselves and we're proud of it. He does go on to make that point. He says that, you know, if you do build this apparatus that protects you when you sleep so that your thorn never gets touched, he says then you can sleep now, and then other people say they have that problem and you tell them what they've done, and you end up on TV and you end up selling this product and you're getting paid lots of royalties and you're really proud of the apparatus that you built. But you have to sleep with this apparatus every night. You know, you're not free. In fact, he goes on to say, in fact, you have to change the doors in the house so that you and your protective apparatus can get through. Like I said, he gets a little silly. But the point is that we build our entire life in order to avoid being triggered, having our things we least want to look at, having it be touched. He calls those our inner thorns. He says, if you don't solve the root cause of the problem, but instead attempt to protect yourself from the problem, it ends up running your life. You end up so psychologically fixated on the problem that you can't see the forest for the trees. You actually feel that because you've minimized the pain of the problem, you've solved the problem. but it is not solved. All you did was devote your life to avoiding it. It is now the center of your universe. Now, after this, he uses loneliness as an example. Someone who's trying to avoid feeling lonely. They don't like feeling lonely. And, of course, if we were to take a person who doesn't like feeling lonely and practice root cause inquiry, my guess is we would find that they believe that they're so unworthy nobody wants to be around them, right? And that's why they don't like loneliness. Being alone, loneliness is a constant reminder of what a loser I am. Everybody else has friends. Everybody else has somebody to go out to dinner with and the movies with, but not me. I'm the scum of the earth, right? That's probably what would be underneath that fear of loneliness. So he's using the fear of loneliness as an example. He says, in order to apply the analogy of the thorn to your life, we will use loneliness as an example. Let's say you have a very deep sense of inner loneliness. It's so deep that you have trouble sleeping at night, and during the day it makes you very sensitive. You're susceptible to feeling sharp pangs in your heart that cause quite a disturbance. You have trouble staying focused on your job, and you have trouble with everyday interactions. What's more, when you're very lonely, it's often painfully difficult to get close to people. You see, loneliness is just like the thorn. It causes pain and disturbance in all aspects of your life. And, of course, we could replace loneliness with anything that any of us try to avoid, right? But in the case of the human heart, he says, we have more than one thorn. We have sensitivities about loneliness, about rejection, about our physical appearance, about our mental prowess. And that's a very short list, I think. I think we have sensitivities about much more than that. We are walking around with lots of thorns touching right against the most sensitive part of our hearts. At any moment, something can touch them and cause pain inside. You have the same two choices with these inner thorns as you did with the imaginary thorn in your arm. Surely it was obvious that you would have been much better off just taking that thorn out of your arm. There's no reason to spend your life protecting the thorn from getting touched when you can just remove it. Once the thorn is removed, you are truly free of it. The same is true with your inner thorns. They can be removed. But if you choose to keep them without being disturbed by them, you must modify your life to avoid situations that would stir them up. And one situation that keeps coming to my mind is wearing a bathing suit in public. some of you may have seen on Facebook, I recently posted a picture of myself in a bathing suit. And the people who know me well, like Danielle and Jasmine, they might see that as some type of an accomplishment because Regina is a person who has avoided wearing a bathing suit most of her life since she was very young, maybe age 19 or so. I just always felt that my body was ugly and that it needed to be hidden or everyone would know the depth of my unworthiness. And what's a little sad to me is that I watch my daughter, who is, beautiful, doing the same thing. She won't wear a bathing suit. These are the kinds of things that we do to ourselves, right? Because we don't want to feel that unworthiness. And so we avoid wearing a bathing suit or whatever it is that we do. So again, there's no reason to spend your life protecting the thorn from getting touched when you can just remove it. Once the thorn is removed, you are truly free of it. The same is true with your inner thorns. They can be removed. But if you choose to keep them without being disturbed by them, you must modify your life to avoid the situations that would stir them up. And he gives the example, if you're lonely, you maybe have to avoid going to places where couples tend to be. If you're afraid of rejection, you have to avoid getting too close to people, etc. Going back to the example of lonely, he says, when you're lonely, you find yourself pondering what to do about your loneliness. What is it that you can say or do in order to not feel so lonely? Listen to this sentence. First, let me read the last sentence again, and then listen to this sentence. So you keep pondering, what is it that you can say or do in order to not feel so lonely? This is the way we tend to go about our problems. What can I do? You know, like if I'm Jacqueline and I think I'm stupid, what can I do not to appear so stupid? Ah, I'll go to Harvard, become a lawyer, right? You know, if I'm Regina, what can I do to not appear so ugly? Ah, I'll just never wear a bathing suit or shorts or a short skirt, right? I'll hide my body. So that's the way we look at it, right? What is it that you can say or do in order to not feel blank? And then he says, notice that you aren't asking how to get rid of the problem. You're asking how to protect yourself from feeling it. And that's a pretty aha type of statement, you know, that when we feel unworthy, whether it's because we think we're ugly or we think we're stupid or whatever the issue is, when we feel unworthy, we just try to escape feeling that way. We create something in our lives, we do something in our lives to escape feeling that way, but it doesn't occur to us to ask, how do I get rid of this sense of unworthiness? It's not true. I don't have to live with it. What are the steps? Can somebody please tell me the steps to be free of this false belief? People don't go around asking that question. Notice that you aren't asking how to get rid of the problem. You're asking how to protect yourself from feeling it. You do this either by avoiding situations or by using people, places, and things as protective shields. Or like I said, in my case, right, in my case, I also moved to the right town. I did get the right job, got my daughter in the right school. You know, all of that to make me look better than I thought I was. He says, you're going to end up just like the person with the thorn. The loneliness or the whatever will run your entire life. The problem will be back the moment the external situation fails to protect you from what's inside. Right? The problem will be back the moment the external situation fails to protect you from what's inside. So if you listen to the audio, you know then, as I just told you all, that I spent my entire life hiding my body. And then Laurent was coming, right? You heard that in the audio. Laurent was coming. And not only was Laurent coming, but Laurent had told me how he had dated all of these models. So now I have a guy that has all of these expectations, has been with all these beautiful, beautiful women, and he's going to come and see me. You see, so the fact that I spent my entire life hiding my body didn't save me from the problem. It may be, to some degree, put it off, but eventually the problem arose anyway. I have to get intimate with someone in this lifetime, and the gig is going to be up. And, of course, that led to a deep, deep, deep dip into the unworthiness. But if you heard the story, I used the deep, deep, deep dip. The specific story, and I don't think I told it in great detail in the audio, so since we have time, I'll just go ahead and tell the story now. What happened was this huge fear came up. And it was really the fear of Laurent being the one who finally saw the fact of how unworthy I really was. Like he would be the witness to what I had always tried to hide. And it was just the fear of this, the inevitability of this. As fear started to rise, I went into the bedroom and I laid on the bed. And what I did was I practiced rest, accept, and trust with the fear. I just, and this is not proper English, but it feels like the right thing to say. I just be'd with it, you know, be in past tense, because I was being with it. I just be'd with it. And as I mentioned in the audio, as I stayed with this fear, it actually grew more and more and more intense. And it went beyond the original fear, which was the story, the fear of Laurent seeing me without clothes on and then knowing how incredibly unworthy I was, right? It went beyond that, and it came to this point in the mind where I found a belief that if I really gave myself wholeheartedly to the spiritual process and did not defend myself in any way, because, you know, again, our life is full of defenses. And so if we give ourselves wholeheartedly to the spiritual process, we're not we let go of all defenses. You know, and if I did that, if I did not hold on to any defense at all, if I just let go of every defense I ever built to try and make myself feel safe, and I went to God completely, completely vulnerable and said, here I am. There was this belief in my mind that he would point right at me and say, not you. Like everyone else is accepted. Everyone else. But not you. I mean, I really saw how singular that feeling was. You know, that only I was not good enough for God. And that was actually on the first night of this fear. I didn't go into as much detail in the audio, but this fear actually lasted 2 nights. So on the second evening, the fear started kicking up again. I did the exact same thing. I went to bed and I laid there in bed and by the way, the way I remember it, when I say I laid there in bed and was rest, accepted, and trusted with the fear and all, I just want you to know the way I remembered it, both of these nights were like, you know, about 5 hours of laying in bed with fear, not 10 minutes. So on the second night, I hate to tell you guys this stuff, you know, I don't want to scare you away, but at the same time, I want you to know, you know, that sometimes we have to have patience with these processes. And I want you to know it's normal if you find yourself not able to go let go of fear in 5 minutes, right? So on the second night, the same thing happened, and I went and I laid in bed, and again, I just be'd with the fear. And I went past the place where I was the first night being that feeling that I would singularly be rejected by God. I went right past that, and I went into a space where there was no God. And by that I mean the idea of a God and a me, that's still a duality, that's still an other. There's a me and something else called God, right? On the second night, I went past that to where there was no God, there was no other, there was only me. Only this me wasn't Regina. And this me, nor was this me enlightened awakening. This me was, I think I called it in the audio, big ego. But this me was formless ego, right? Formless ego. I don't know what else to call it. I was everything, but still ego. And what happened on the second night when I reached that state within, is that I saw that there was this fear that I would singularly reject myself, that I would reject myself with a finality, like never ever take it back again. And since we can never get away from ourself, especially our big self, if we were to reject ourselves with finality, where we would never take it back again, that would be pure hell. just unimaginable, unending hell. And in fact, I even remember thinking this might be where the idea of hell came from. You know, somebody may have been describing the state in the mind that they got to, and somebody else may have misunderstood it as something that God does to you. You know, that this unending hell, it would be what we would do to ourselves by rejecting ourselves so fully. But then right after I saw that, and this is the part I can't explain, which is why I called it a miracle, right after I saw that, I also saw that would never happen. That it's simply not possible. And this was where the sense of freedom came from. Like, I knew that that final rejection was an impossibility. And I can't explain that except to say that when we stick with rest, accept, and trust, and we don't shrink away from it, it heals. Right? So I went all the way through the darkness regarding that belief. All the way through the darkness. I didn't hide from it. I didn't run from it. I didn't defend myself from it. I just laid there and beed with it. And as a result, it healed. I didn't heal it. It healed. And I saw that that could never, ever, ever happen. It just disappeared. So let me see what I read that led to that story. Well, I don't remember what I read, but here's something that I think was along the last thing that I read. The root problem, oh, maybe I'm looking at the wrong page. Maybe that's why. Oh, yeah, here's the last thing I read. The problem we back the moment the external situation fails to protect you from what's inside. So what brought that story up was I spent my whole life trying to hide my body. And then a situation was coming at me where my body was going to be seen by a guy with very high expectations, and that brought all this stuff up. But instead of trying to hide from it in some way, right, you know, like choosing to break up with Laurent, I could have done that, broke up with him before he even came, said, never mind, I don't want to do this, right? I could have avoided it, right? Instead of doing that, I practiced rest, accept, and trust with it, and it healed. So again, we set up all of these problems to try and avoid, but we can't actually avoid these false beliefs. Something will come along to trigger them. And then what are we going to do? Are we going to build a bigger apparatus? Or are we going to embrace the opportunity for healing? Those are our choices. He says the root problem, now he's talking about if you have built your life in order to hide the problem. He says the root problem is now buried underneath all of these shallower issues. And examples of shallower issues, he says, are things like staying up all night worrying, did I say the right thing? You know, does so-and-so really like me, or are they thinking bad things about me? I call them the stories in the mind. And the stories in the mind cover up, which you've now learned because we've practiced root cause inquiry, the stories in the mind cover up the actual root cause of the problem. And that's what he's saying too. The root problem is buried under all these shallower issues. So when we worry about, you know, how am I going to save money, or how am I going to make more money, or, you know, whatever it is that we worry about, what we're really doing, we're staying at the surface level of the problem. Peace Pilgrim talks about this too. She calls it the surface level of the problem, instead of going deep down inside of the problem and healing it. So this is why we practice root cause inquiry. The purpose of root cause inquiry is to get us out of the surface into the depth so that we can see the actual problem. And then when we see the actual problem and we realize, yes, that's definitely a problem in my mind, like Sherry was saying, you know, I definitely saw in my mind how much unworthiness is there, right? That's actually a giant step forward. Even if we're shocked, like she said, she was shocked. That's still a giant step forward. In fact, probably shock is too giant step forward to see it that clearly. Because then the root isn't hidden underneath all these shallower issues anymore. And then we can begin healing it. He says, do not doubt your ability to remove the root cause of the disturbance inside of you. Oh, Sharon says, when people commit suicide, aren't they turning against themselves? I would say when people commit suicide, it's just another attempt at avoiding the same things that we all try to avoid in different ways. You know, it may seem more extreme. I once asked Holy Spirit about suicide. There was a point in my counseling career when I actually had 3 people that were considering committing suicide, and I had no idea what to say to these people. So I went and asked Spirit what I should say. And basically the answer was to tell them that, you know, if they commit suicide, they accomplish nothing. Because they're trying to avoid, you know, again, the language we're using tonight is this thorn in their arm, the thorn in the mind. But when they commit suicide, that thorn goes with them. Even suicide is not a way to avoid it. Right? Even suicide. Again, like this sentence said, the problem will be back the moment the external situation fails to protect you from what's inside. And I guess, you know, we'll have to go with the theory of reincarnation, although I don't know that for a fact. But if we follow the theory of reincarnation, they're just reborn into another life with the same thorn in their mind. So even suicide is not an escape. The interesting thing was, when I explained that, none of the 3 people chose to commit suicide, because the truth is they were trying to escape some pain. And when they realized that suicide was not an escape and the best thing to do was to stay and face it with a healing perspective, all 3 of them chose not to commit suicide. So do not doubt your ability to remove the root cause of the disturbance inside of you. It really can go away. You can look deep within yourself to the core of your being and decide that you don't want the weakest part of you running your life. You can look deep within yourself to the core of your being and decide that you don't want the weakest part of you running your life. And that is what I would say somehow I did. Obviously, in order to have gone through that 5 years of practicing rest, accept, and trust every time the unworthiness was triggered, of making the decision to start taking back my judgments, both my judgments of myself and my judgments of others, choosing, even though I saw the judgments, choosing not to believe them with finality, right? Take them back. The only reason that I would do that is because I had faith that this could be healed, and because I had made the decision, I didn't want that running my life anymore. And again, remember, I had discovered that it ran my life. I had discovered that I was in the job I was in. I was living in the town I was in. My daughter was going to the school she was in. She was taking the lessons that she was taking, all because it was a mask. I had seen that this unworthiness belief was running my life. And I had realized I didn't know what my life would be like if I had chosen my life out of freedom. And so I decided in that I wanted to be free of this so that I could, I would say, know myself without it. And so it's that decision that enabled, that gave me the stick-with-itness, right? The consistency, the ability to go through that 5 years, because that's just how long it took for me, to go through that 5 years of letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, until it didn't need to happen that way anymore. And I think I described in the audio the last time I really felt that unworthiness as a belief, which was that first trip to Israel when I thought that I was really messing up by taking Jasmine out of school for 8 days to take her with me. And so now I guess I do know what it's like to live free of that belief. And it makes life a lot easier, right? Traveling lightly, as Paul Hederman said, right? So do not doubt your ability to remove the root cause of the disturbance inside of you. It really can go away. You can look deep within yourself to the core of your being and decide that you don't want the weakest part of you running your life. You want to be free of this. And then he says, how do you free yourself? In the deepest sense, you free yourself by finding yourself. You are not the pain you feel. Because your consciousness is separate and aware of these things, you can free yourself. If you want, you can simply permit the disturbances to come up and you can let them go. So again, without using my language, what he's describing is rest, accept, and trust. You can choose to take that observer position. You can, you know, if you have to, lay on the bed like I laid on the bed and just be with it. Just watch it. In fact, that's the only way that I got so deep into the mind that I saw the false belief to the level that I saw it, is because I was doing nothing but watching. I didn't make that up. I didn't think that up. I wasn't trying to figure out how to think my way into healing. I was just being with it, and it traveled its own path, and I watched it, and I saw where it went. I saw how dark it got, and then I saw the truth. So it's by being that observer and really staying out of the way of it. You don't, in a way, you don't do anything to heal it. You stop doing things. In fact, one of the review lessons we did recently was with Steve Ford's experience, right? His awakening experience, which was very fast and very dramatic. But remember, in his awakening experience, the way he went from the head, and the head would have been when the thoughts disappeared, but then he went to the heart, and there were what he called emotional thoughts, and they had to be freed as well, right? And he talked about how when he went into the heart and he felt this pain, right, the pain of the world, he describes it, but he talks about how the reason all of this happened was because he was no longer doing anything. Right? See, what we do is we defend against that. In fact, the voice told him all of his life he'd been running from this, right? From experiencing what was in the heart, meaning the pain in the heart. So it's by not doing anything, because when we do something, we defend. It's by not doing anything that we're able to travel through this, that happens on its own, and emerge on the other side. So what we have to do is get very, very good at doing nothing but watching. But then he says, the problem is you either completely avoid situations that would cause them to release, or you push them back down in the name of protecting yourself. In other words, the problem is we don't just watch it until it completes itself and is healed. We either avoid the situation that would bring up the unworthiness in the first place. We decide to break it off with Laurent. Never mind, I don't want to do this, right? We avoid the situation because it's scaring us. Or we make up some story at the level of mind that helps push it back down and protect ourselves. Stories are protection devices, right? We make something up at the head level. The problem is you either completely avoid situations that would cause them to release, or you push them back down in the name of protecting yourself. All right, here he goes into another example. Suppose you're sitting at home watching TV. You're enjoying the program until the two main characters fall in love. Suddenly you feel that loneliness. But there's no one around to give you attention, to help you escape the loneliness. Interestingly, you were fine a few minutes ago. This example shows that the thorn is always in your heart. It's just not activated until something touches it. He says, what can you do to solve this besides eating something, calling somebody, or doing something else that might quiet it down? You know, and what this sentence says to me is, can we discover the ways that we avoid our pain? Whatever our pain is, you know, what is it? When the pain starts coming up, what do I run to? Do I run to food? Do I run to drinking? Do I run to social, you know, surround me with lots and lots of people, social interactions? Do I run to TV, get deeper and deeper in TV? Do I run to sleep? Some people go to sleep to avoid life. You know, what do I run to? How do I avoid life? It'd be really wonderful to discover that. And then the next time I start to be triggered, can I resist my defense? Can I not run and get the food, or not go to bed, or not get up and grab my coat and go to a bar, or whatever that I do to avoid it? Can I not do that and allow myself to feel the pain? What can you do to solve this besides eating something, calling somebody, or doing something else that might quiet it down? What you can do is notice that you noticed. You can notice that your consciousness was watching TV, and now it is watching your inner melodrama. The one who sees this is you, the subject. What you are looking at is an object. A feeling of emptiness is an object. It's something that you feel. But who feels it? He says your way out is just to notice who's noticing. Right? Again, just watching. I think it was Ken Wapnick who used to talk about sitting in the balcony with Jesus, watching. Regina, would you say being vulnerable is the same as allowing to feel the pain, to just go through it and just feel it? Yes, I would say that. Because again, what we want to do is defend. So there's a very vulnerable feeling when we're allowing it to just happen. If you want to be free of these energies, you must allow them to pass through you instead of hiding them inside of you. And again, you just listened to an audio where I did that over and over and over again. You know, I get tired of my own story, so I was pretty tired of the audio. I was like, oh my God, another story. However, the point that I took from that was, this was someone who just kept repeating the same practice every time the false belief got triggered. Just every time, no matter how big it got, she just kept repeating the same practice of rest, accept, and trust. And also the other practice of not filling the cup up again by believing judgments, right? And she just kept doing it. Story after story, she did the same thing. And it didn't matter which story it was, the story itself didn't throw her off of the simplicity of the practice. And this is why it was healed. She didn't get distracted by the story. If you want to be free of these energies, you must allow them to pass through you instead of hiding them inside of you. And then he gives an example of how you can learn to watch, because some people need to learn to watch, right? And basically, the word I use to describe this is curiosity. He says, again, he's still using the example of loneliness. He says, you can notice that you notice, and then just watch how experiencing loneliness affects you. Does your posture change? Do you breathe slower or faster? What goes on when loneliness is given the space it needs to pass through you? Be an explorer. Witness it and then it will go. Right? So, you know, for most of us, let's say the unworthiness is starting to rise up. Again, what we do is we close down and defend. This is exactly the opposite. It's not defending, and it's opening up to the point that you're looking at, my God, what does it feel like to feel unworthy? Oh, I notice that I really feel it heavily in my chest. Oh, I notice it even kind of radiates out to my elbows and my hands. Oh, there's even a taste in my mouth. You see, you explore it. And as you're exploring it, you're allowing it to be and you're being with it. And it will go away. Obviously, our greatest enemy, I'm not the first one to have said this, is fear. Right? Our greatest enemy is fear. If I'm afraid to feel unworthy or afraid to feel guilty or afraid to feel afraid, I'm going to do whatever I can to avoid it. So we need to replace fear with curiosity. When I'm afraid, what does being afraid feel like? How does this body experience fear? You know, what kinds of thoughts show up in the mind to try and protect the self? How does this body try and protect itself? But just the watching. Let's see, he says, be an explorer, witness it, and then it will go. If you don't get absorbed in it, the experience will pass and something else will come up. Just enjoy all of it. If you can do this, you will be free, and a world of pure energy will open up within you. The more you sit in the self, and by this he means the observer, the watcher, the more you sit in the self, the more you will begin to feel an energy that you have never experienced before. It comes up from behind rather than in front where you experience your mind and emotions. And I got to tell you, this is exactly how I experience it. It comes from behind instead of from the front. I was pretty surprised the first time I saw this, you know, the first time I read this, because that was exactly my experience. The thinking, the emotions, the world is all up front. And you get to the point where you can feel that. It's up front. And this is behind. And it comes up from behind, and it begins to move gradually forward into the foreground. But it comes from behind. I don't know else to say that. That's exactly what it feels like. It says, the more you sit in the self, the more you'll begin to feel an energy that you have never experienced before. It comes up from behind rather than in front where you experience your mind and emotions. When you are no longer absorbed in your melodrama, but instead sit comfortably deep inside the seat of awareness, you will start to feel this flow of energy coming up from deep within. This flow has been called Shakti. This flow has been called Spirit. This is what you begin to experience if you hang out with the self instead of hanging out with the inner disturbances. So again, stay as the watcher. You don't have to get rid of loneliness, or you don't have to get rid of unworthiness, or you don't have to get rid of guilt, or you don't have to get rid of anxiety. You just cease to be involved with it. The way it says it in a Ramana, you just lose interest in it. Right? You just cease to be involved with it. It's just another thing in the universe, like cars, grass, and the stars. And think about how many things that you experience every day that you don't get involved with. Think about how many times somebody's talking to you and you're not listening. You don't even get involved with that. I mean, if there's one thing that we all know how to do, it's how not to be interested in something, how not to get involved with something. So we already have that skill. We just take that skill and we apply it to our own mind, to its stories and to its root cause beliefs. Just let things go, or we could also say just let things be, including whatever shows up in you. You just don't get involved with it. Remember, you're the watcher. You're not the controller. You're not trying to control this from showing up. You watch it show up, and you don't get involved with it. You don't have interest in it. You don't want it. Just let things go. That's what the self does. Awareness does not fight. Awareness releases. Awareness is simply aware, while everything in the universe parades before it. If you sit within the self, you will experience the strength of your inner being, even when your heart feels weak. This is the essence of the path. This is the essence of a spiritual life. Once you learn that it's okay to feel inner disturbances, and that they can no longer disturb your seat of consciousness, you will be free. Once you learn that it's okay to feel inner disturbances, you don't have to avoid them. You don't have to set up your life to avoid them, right? Once you learn that it's okay to feel inner disturbances, and that they can no longer disturb your seat of consciousness, you will be free. You will begin to be sustained by the inner energy flow that comes from behind you. When you have tasted the ecstasy of the inner flow, you can walk in this world and the world will never touch you. That's how you become a free being. You transcend. And that's the end of the chapter. Now, we do still have some time, and I just remember that a couple people posted some videos in the sharing and contemplation group this week that I haven't had a chance to watch, and they apply to everything that we're doing in the Gentle Healing Group. So maybe what I can do is just play the audio of these videos, at least the first one. We'll see if we have time for the second one. So the first one is something that I think Kathy Smith posted. It's an 8-minute video from Adyashanti. So why don't we just listen to this, see what Adya has to say. Let me know if I need changes in the volume.
So what I'm speaking about is when we really, the eye of spirit, our true nature, really opens. And what it sees is it sees itself. That's what it sees. In all the various manifestations it has shown up, whether it's a human being or a thought in your head, or a flower, or a chair, or a carpet, that the eye of spirit sees itself primarily. Of course the eye of spirit sees differences. It sees that this body is different from that body, and a chair is different from a flower. But it sees that secondarily. It sees that secondarily, that everything is actually spirit. And then the diversity is, spirit is a very diverse thing. It can manifest itself in anything. So this is when we really see this, when you really grok it, you know, not intellectually, but you really grok it with your heart and your gut and your being, and it kind of, like, you know, when you grok something, it kind of takes your breath away? Because your whole body has understood, not just your head, your whole being has got it, and you realize there's nothing wrong. And nothing, see, because the mind itself uses everything as proof that there is something wrong, right? You wake up and you're sleepy, and your mind, you know, all enlightened people wouldn't wake up sleepy. See, there's something wrong, right?
I am bad.
It's like a prosecuting attorney, and it's gathering evidence, right? If you have an ache here or there, there's something wrong. You see, it's proof that you're just a slobby ego. I knew it was true, because I had this feeling, or I thought this thought, or I did something, or I didn't do anything. And either way, it's proof that there's... I actually am sort of a rotten slob after all. Everything is used as evidence, right? That there's an ego. I mean, I even have people come up, you know, and oh, I'm having a good, I feel great. I go, wonderful. Yeah, I feel great. But there's an I that feels great. So that means I'm not enlightened. You see, everything becomes problematic. You see, so even if you feel good, if you have the thought, I feel good, then you go, oh, there's an I, and there's not really supposed to be an I, and oh God, there's more proof that I haven't quite made it. It's never ending, is it? It's just never ending. Like a good prosecutor, they'll use any information, right? And then, you know, you spin it to its advantage. So this is the conditioned mind. It spins everything into inadequacy. Everything. Everything that ever happened, everything that's happening now, everything that'll happen tomorrow, everything becomes proof that something's wrong. See? That something is not spirit right now. See? That's what oneness means, that there's only one. And when there's only one, well, then there's only one, isn't there? And if there's only one, well, this sounds simple, but there's certainly not two. Right? And if there's only one, it means that whatever's happening is the one. So if you have beautiful posture, there's the divine taking beautiful posture. If you have rotten posture, there's the divine having rotten posture. If you're healthy, there's the divine having been very healthy. And if you're, you know, sick with the flu in the bed or whatever, there's the divine having the flu. But it's all one thing. And when you really start to get this, you see how the mind has gathered evidence that some part of your experience is somehow proof that even though you might speak about the one and it's all one and oneness and da-da-da-da-da, that some things are proof that it's not all one. Usually you. At least not as you are. Right? Or maybe you had, you know, a really rotten history, a really rotten, difficult past. And you go, well, the one wouldn't have a rotten, difficult past. Well, apparently it does, doesn't it? What's the proof? Here you are, rotten, difficult past. The one had a rotten, you see what I mean? It's still the one. And so all these vary. For some people, of course, these ideas are more conscious in the sense that they're actually consciously thinking these ridiculous thoughts to themselves and believing them. And then other people, they're very unconscious. They're like a stream that's operating and they don't even know it. Because, of course, if this stream wasn't operating, then not only would you be the one, you would know that you were the one. So you'd be totally self-realized, whether it's operating consciously or unconsciously. You see? So in a sense, it was surprising to realize in retrospect that without even knowing it, without being aware of it in any way, that this sense of chasing oneness while denying oneself. It's on the face of it, it's ludicrous, isn't it? It's like logic 101. It just doesn't make any sense that it's all one, but something's wrong with me. If I do something right, then I'll get to enter the group of oneness. This is the sense that is ego. That is what keeps separate, the appearance of separate self moving and operating. That's what it is. Just try to get a good egoic moment going without any belief that there's a problem. Just try. there's no problem with you, if there's no problem with them, if there's no problem now, if there's no problem tomorrow. See, the egoic momentum that causes separation, it doesn't have any fuel anymore. You know, it's like a kitchen appliance with no electrical outlet. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying what you sometimes hear spiritual teachers or whatever say, that, you know, everything is perfect. I don't know what everything is perfect means. Everything is the one. I get that. Everything is the one. There is only God, however you want to put it. Everything is that. Perfection adds sort of an extra layer. It's an interpretive layer. And the way it is perfect. No, it's not. It's just the way it is. It's not perfect and it's not imperfect. That's duality. That's the mind seeking refuge in a safe place. But this isn't about this isn't about a safe place. This is about the truth.
All right, so one thing he said was try to get the ego going without a problem. You know, and the way I would say that is, he said that the ego has to have a problem. That's where it gets its momentum. And the way I would say that is the ego is the wish for something different than what is. Remember, that's what NTI Romans 2 and 3 teaches us. The ego is the wish for something different than what is. Which is the same as saying the ego needs a problem. The ego needs something to be wrong with you. The ego needs something to be wrong with the world, right? Let's see what this other video is that was posted. This one's 12 minutes long, so we'll just barely have time to watch it. It's called Exploring Uncomfortable Feelings, and it was posted by Christine Amber.
Ask yourself Rupert the question, Spira. What is my experience made of? If that any particular moment is the most interesting thing you can think of doing at that moment. If nothing else that is on offer could trump that question. In other words, if you feel, this is what I would really love to do now, to explore what my experience is made of, then explore it. In other words, do it for that reason, because out of interest, enthusiasm, love for the truth. Don't do it as any kind of a discipline. I think I should be doing this. Or anything that strengthens the separate self.
And to remove discomfort, would that strengthen the separate self?
Not at all. It's natural if you've been sitting in a position for 15 or 20 minutes. It's just natural for the body to want to shift into a different position, or you may have a particular condition, you may have a sore neck or a sore back, in which case for you may want to lie on the floor during meditation or instead of sitting on a chair, or you may want to stand up and walk around during meditation instead of sitting still, in which case you just quietly walk up and down overnight.
And emotional discomfort?
Emotional discomfort is a different thing, because emotional discomfort always revolves around a separate self. Pain in your neck doesn't necessarily revolve around a separate self. Now, emotional discomfort, suffering, revolves around a separate self. So in that case, rather than doing what the discomfort is asking you to do, which is to relieve it or avoid it, it would be better to explore the separate self around whom it revolves. Because if you...
Say more about that.
Okay, but let me just say this first. If you relieve the discomfort of the separate... the emotional discomfort. Let me try to give you an example. Let's say you're sitting. There are no demands on your attention. And because there's nothing for you to engage with, a feeling of loneliness, like a kind of an atmosphere of loneliness begins to settle on you, or sorrow. Now, that's uncomfortable. Now, thought will provide all sorts of ways of avoiding the discomfort of that feeling. For instance, I go to the fridge, get something to eat, check my emails, have a drink, do something. In other words, we don't realize it, but many of our activities are initiated solely for the purpose of avoiding this dis-ease, this sort of pervasive feeling that something is missing or something is lacking. Even, of course, the really, the kind of, that there are a series of kind of gross objects that are the common objects, substances, food, etc. But there are much subtler ways in which we avoid the discomfort of these feelings. And thinking, repetitive thinking is one of them. It's not illegal, it's not bad for our health. So we just find ourselves dreaming, daydreaming. Off we go into the future. The sole purpose of that daydreaming thought is to deflect attention away from the discomfort of this sorrow, which seems to be at the center of ourselves. So the first thing to do is to become very sensitive to the impulse to avoid the uncomfortable feelings, either through the gross ways or probably these more subtle ways. Even sometimes reading an Advaita book or watching the next YouTube clip on non-duality can be just a way of giving your attention to an object so that we don't have to fully feel this ease. So that's what I mean by don't do what the feeling is asking you to do. What the feeling is asking you to do is avoid it or suppress it. So don't do either. Do the opposite. Turn around and face it. Let the feeling come totally to you. And face it so fully that you can keep facing it, keep living with the feeling, opening yourself to the feeling until you can truly say that there is not the slightest resistance to it. And you have to be very careful because, of course, the separate self will turn even this into a technique for getting rid of the feeling. In other words, I'm allowing the feeling so that I can get rid of it. That's not allowing the feeling. So you have to really, really take time and check with yourself that the feeling is being allowed without the slightest resistance to it. And the test of that is you say to yourself, can I live with this feeling forever? You have to be able to answer yes to that question. When you can answer yes, honestly, to that question, you know that there's no resistance to it. And then, turn around and look at the feeling again and see what remains of it. So that's one approach. That's approach that goes directly to the feeling. Another approach would be to explore the separate self around whom the feeling revolves. Because the feeling is always a sensation in the body plus a line of thinking. And that line of thinking always has the separate self as the main character. So let's say there's a feeling of sorrow. The feeling of sorrow will be felt here or here. It will have a bodily component to it. But there will also be an accompanying commentary that revolves around a separate me character. So the first thing to do in this case is to explore that separate I. Go towards yourself. Take yourself through the inquiry again. Discover if that separate self is really present. Is it really what you are? If you would go to the feeling of I am, do you really feel a separate, limited, located awareness, or do you find ever-present, unlimited being? So, in this way, you're exploring the thought aspect of the feeling. The feeling has a bodily aspect and a thought aspect. You're exploring the thought aspect that revolves around the separate I. Now, having discovered that the separate I is non-existent, the whole story that was revolving around it, it can no longer stand. Then you're just left with the sensation in the body, this wave of sensation that was part of the sad feeling. And then you explore the sensation in a similar way that we did this morning. You just go to the raw sensation. And you explore it. And that exploration, the kind of exploration we did, it is a way of, although we don't realize it when we're doing it, we are actually flushing out the me feeling from the body. Seeing that the body is just transparent vibration, permeated with empty knowing.
So the what is it made of seems to me to apply to both the inquiry in the body or of the thought.
Are you referring to your experience in general? What is your experience in general? Or are you? Do you mean what is this uncomfortable feeling made
and
of?
As you were talking and I was following you, it felt like both lines are covered by the question, what is it made of? And so it's feeling at this moment as if the question is coming spontaneously, and maybe my separate self is on a hunt for itself and suspicious of its motives, which is a good game. But yes, that question seems to cover a lot. What is it made of? And it's always
what is the uncomfortable feeling made of?
Yes. And also now when you were talking about exploring the separate self through,
yes,
it does it exist?
Yes. That's it. Yeah. You have an uncomfortable feeling. What is its nature? Yeah. You can either go the first way, which is just to allow the feeling so completely that there is no resistance to it, and then you turn around and look at the feeling again, see what remains of its discomfort when there is no resistance to it. Or go this other route, which is to, it's a little more analytical in some ways. You explore the thought component and see that the main character on whom the feeling depends, the separate me, is simply not there. And then all that remains is a neutral sensation in the body. So that those are the, yes, but both those, the exploration of the thought and of the subsequent exploration of the sensation is part of the what is it made of inquiry, yes. And you should feel free to just use any of these tools that feel appropriate. Sometimes you may feel like this very razor sharp analytical approach which slices experience up looking for the separate self. Other times you may feel that's too, you don't feel like that. You just want to sit with the feeling and totally welcome it, become aware of your resistance to it, and just go on opening yourself more and more to the feeling until there's not the slightest resistance to it. So use all these tools, but always we should be guided by what we love to do, what we're interested in doing. Never make it a technique that you or a practice that you impose on yourself out of discipline, duty, I think I should, this is good for me. All that just strengthens the separate self.
All right, so I want to say thank you to Christine and Kathy for those two videos. And now I'll probably run over a couple of minutes. Funny, I finished early. I'm going to finish late. Oh, Ken says the radio computer will be offline this Friday morning while his internet service is moved to his new house. Also, I want to say next week I'm on vacation, so Jacqueline will be here. She will lead the Gentle Healing Group next week. And now I want to give you your homework for the next week. So homework assignment A, workbook lessons 181 to 187, and we're getting into some really good workbook lessons with these. So I hope you guys enjoy them. They get very deep. I really love them. And of course, continuing the practice of daily awareness watching awareness meditation for 15 to 20 minutes and continuing to practice the loving all method. Assignment B, we're going to go back to NTI. We're going to read NTI John chapters 1 through 7, and that's pages 187 to 197. Lots of sevens in that. In fact, listen to this. We're doing workbook lessons 181 to 187. We're reading NTI John chapters 1 through 7, and that's pages 187 to 197. Lots of sevens next week. And then we also have a homework assignment C. We're going to practice the 30-minute meditation called Introduction to Loving Consciousness Meditation, and you're asked to do this at least once. If you like it, you can do it more than once. And the reason that we're doing this, I'm going to start introducing to you all over the next few weeks some what I'm going to call alternative methods of meditation, just in case there's anyone who, after all of this practice we've been doing, still doesn't feel the awareness, watching awareness meditation. There are some other options, and so I'm going to start introducing them, and one of them is the loving consciousness meditation. So there's a 30-minute audio. Please practice that at least once. Kim will put that in the homework, but in the homework post, but you can also find it at awakening-together.org under audios and videos, meditation audios, devotional meditation. Again, that's under audios and videos, meditation audios, devotional meditation. And just scroll down until you find the one called Introduction to Loving Consciousness Meditation. All right, so I will still be doing the homework with you and writing tips, even though I will be away on vacation. Jacqueline will be here with you next Tuesday night, and I will be here with you in 2 weeks. All right, everybody, thanks for participating in Gentle Healing. Bye.